What the hell is going on right now? And why is it happening like this? At Wired, we're obsessed with getting to the bottom of those questions, and maybe you are too. I'm Katie Drummond, the Global Editorial Director of Wired, and I'm hosting our new podcast series, The Big Interview. Each week, I'll sit down with some of the most interesting, provocative, and influential people who are shaping our right now. Listen to The Big Interview right now in the same place you find Wired's Uncanny Valley podcast.
In Darfur, Sudan, tens of thousands of people are fleeing horrific violence. An aid worker speaks to us from a displaced persons camp where some of them are seeking refuge.
Children who are as young as 3 to children who are 16 years old coming unaccompanied.
I'm Carolyn Beeler. Also today, Britain's Prince Andrew has been stripped of his title for his ties to sex offender Jeffrey Epstein and allegations of sexual abuse.
I hope that it's the beginning of a reckoning. You know, this is not just about Prince Andrew.
And Timor-Leste is the newest member of Southeast Asia's main trading bloc. It is also the poorest.
This will lead to the promotion of jobs and industries in Timor-Leste.
Those stories and more are just ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thanks for joining us today. After 2.5 years of devastating civil war in Sudan, things are getting even worse.
The situation is simply horrifying.
That's Martha Pobi speaking at UN headquarters in New York this morning. She is the Assistant Secretary General for Africa at the United Nations. Pobi said no part of Sudan is untouched by the violence. But the stories coming from thousands of people fleeing from the city of Al-Fashir in North Darfur are the worst.
These include credible reports of mass killings in various locations and summary executions during house-to-house searches and as civilians have tried to flee the city. Communications have been cut off. The situation is chaotic. In this context, it is difficult to estimate the number of civilians killed.
In the last few days, about 3,000 people displaced by war have arrived in the town of Tovila. They traveled by foot 35 miles from Al-Fashir after the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, took over the city. For those who've managed to escape, the accounts of what they have been through are harrowing. Shashwat Saraf works with the Norwegian Refugee Council, which is managing a displaced persons camp in Tovila. He arrived there today. Shashwat, can you describe what it is like there at the camp?
What we have here, Carolyn, is a sea of people. We've already had more than 500,000 people who've been displaced since April this year. And now we are seeing people trickling in from the conflict in Al-Fashir a few days back. And people are coming completely dehydrated, traumatized, injured, tired. I've even seen children who are as young as 3 to children who are 16 years old coming unaccompanied, having no family.
You've seen children as young as 3 arriving in the camp unaccompanied?
They are basically coming with people who they don't know. But because people have been moving, if they see a child, they take them along just so that they are protected, safe. So that's why we have registered, even today, 9 children who came unaccompanied with people, completely strangers, but not having any family member with them.
What are you hearing from those who are arriving about what has happened to them on the way from Al-Fashir to Tovila?
So we've heard from young men who've been saying that they have been detained, been beaten, they've come injured, they have not eaten for days, there are marks on their body, and along the way, they have been hiding in different locations to somehow reach Tovila. Once they arrive here in Tovila, they seem very lost. They basically don't know as to how they have finally managed to reach Tovila, which has been their destination since they started moving from Fashir.
So there are men, you're saying, young men who are able to escape al-Fashir, even though the RSF, it seems, is trying to prevent people from escaping. What are you hearing from women and children who are arriving there?
So initially, we saw a lot of women and children arrive on trucks. 50% of the children who are arriving are acutely malnourished. One of our big worries, Carolyn, is the fact that we've estimated that there are about 250,000 people in Fashir. As of now, we've only seen anywhere between 3,000 to 5,000 people come into Tavila. And we don't really know where the remaining people are. People who've been leaving have been trying to hide, avoid. Some have been detained, have been beaten, but still have managed to somehow escape and come all the way. But there are still many, and when I say many, I mean still thousands, who we really don't know where they are.
Do you worry that many of those people have already been killed?
I hope not. But yes, we do worry.
And what about supplies in the refugee camp that you are managing? Are there tents for the new arrivals? Is there enough food and water?
In the IDP camps that we have been providing support in Tavila, we've seen the support is still far from what is required. We don't have enough resources. We don't have enough funds. We don't have enough tents for everyone.
And is there enough food for everyone?
I think there is a lot of community effort as well and local response groups to make sure that there is food provided. But it still is one meal a day that is being made available.
So there's not enough food. Does that mean there might be fewer than one meal a day at some point soon?
We have organizations, we have communities that are ready to step up. I think what is required are committed and flexible resources so that humanitarian assistance can be scaled up to the needs that we see here.
Political pressure also has not been forthcoming in this conflict. Who would need to step up now to change that?
I do feel that globally, we have enough and more nations who should be able to step in to do that. Unfortunately, we haven't seen that so far, but I think to put that pressure now to ensure that they step in this time and al-Fashir does not once again go in history books as one of the places where the population was wiped out because of the ongoing conflict in Sudan.
Shashwat Saraf works with the Norwegian Refugee Council. He's the country lead for Sudan. He joined us from Tavila. Shashwat, thank you so much for this conversation and sharing your observations.
Thank you, Carolyn.
Timor-Leste, also known as East Timor, is one of the youngest countries in the world. It's been an independent state for just over 20 years. This week, the country achieved a milestone by joining the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN. Naina Rao reports on why it took so long and why it matters.
The moment had been years in the making. Cameras flashed and a row of flags framed the stage as government leaders clasped hands with Timor-Leste's prime minister, marking the nation's long-awaited entry into the regional bloc.
Distinguished guests, it is now official. Timor-Leste is the 11th member of ASEAN.
Timor-Leste sits at the far eastern tip of the Indonesian archipelago, just north of Australia. It was a Portuguese colony for centuries, then under Indonesian occupation until independence in 2002. A decade later, the young nation applied to join ASEAN.
Today, history is made. Our path to membership has been long and purposeful.
Timor-Leste Prime Minister Khairala Sanana Gusmão says the path to membership took 14 years of struggle, because joining ASEAN isn't just a handshake. It's a high bar. Together, ASEAN's 11 countries make up the world's fifth largest economy, a market the U.S. and China are both eager to court. Meanwhile, Professor Ku Ying-hui, who teaches international relations and human rights at University Malaya in Kuala Lumpur, says ASEAN itself had to decide whether it was ready to welcome its smallest, youngest neighbor.
Well, the journey has been really long due to many reasons. I would say the economic concerns is one of the major hindrances.
Timor-Leste is now ASEAN's poorest member, making up just 0.1% of the region's GDP. Its economy has depended on oil and gas reserves that have been exhausted, according to the IMF, and nearly half the population lives below the poverty line.
Economic pillars has always been one of the main priorities. Meeting another new member has become one of the concerns, how to ensure the regional integration will not be impacted.
Yan Carrier Swallow is the IMF's mission chief to Timor-Leste. He says for nearly 20 years, the country has produced a lot of natural gas offshore, and that's generated a lot of revenue. Over $18 billion stored in a sovereign wealth fund. That's 10 times the national GDP.
Our concern is that if fiscal policy maintains the current levels of expenditure going forward, then we think the fund will eventually run out. But we expect that to happen sometime in the late 2030s.
Carrier Swallow says Timor-Leste's overall spending must be reduced over the next decade, and it should be spent more strategically on public infrastructure and education. For the moment, though, Michael Leach says the country is focusing on the positives of what accession to ASEAN will mean. Leach is a politics professor at Swinburne University in Australia who studies Timor-Leste. He says membership brings both symbolism and opportunity.
The hopes are for increased trade, increased foreign direct investment, freer trade with the ASEAN countries, and this will lead to the promotion of jobs and industries in Timor-Leste. It's a sign of affiliation very strongly to their Southeast Asian identity.
At one point during that 14-year wait, Leach says Timor-Leste even considered turning eastward, aligning more with smaller Pacific Island nations like Fiji. Timor-Leste President Jose Ramos Horta once said that becoming an ASEAN member seemed harder to reach than getting to heaven.
The fact that they've decided to include Timor-Leste, I think, shows that they're taking a broader view of the region. And I'm sure there are geostrategic implications there for including Timor-Leste in the ASEAN family.
Washington has welcomed Timor-Leste's ASEAN membership. According to Leach, it's because it aligns the small nation more closely with Southeast Asian neighbors and Indonesia's orbit, rather than China's. He adds the U.S. position largely mirrors Australia's, which has backed Timor-Leste's bid for that very reason. Back in Kuala Lumpur, Timorese journalist Ramizia Boavida watched her country's flag rise alongside the others and couldn't hold back tears. She says she was proud seeing Timor-Leste's flag placed among the ASEAN nations on the giant screen. Wow, Boavida said. Just wow. She was speechless and moved, saying she felt immense pride because after decades of struggle, her home country, the smallest democracy in Southeast Asia, finally has a seat at the region's biggest table. For the world, I'm Naina Rao in Kuala Lumpur.
Today, Halloween is your chance to be someone or something entirely new for the day. Something fantastic, maybe a superhero or a wild animal. But in Japan, some people take Halloween in a totally different direction, with a tradition called Jimmy Halloween. That translates roughly to mundane Halloween. A Japanese website started the tradition in 2014, and it has grown into a national phenomenon on social media. The goal is to dress up and use props to conjure an ordinary but mildly frustrating situation, and then take a picture and put it online with a caption. Here's one example. Uber delivery man surprised when resident comes out a front door despite instructions to just drop it off. The photo shows a guy in everyday clothes looking startled as he sets down a plastic bag with a receipt stapled to it. The scene is framed by an open apartment door.
Or how about person trying hard not to buy plastic bags? This one's just a person precariously juggling multiple grocery items in their arms. I've been there. Ironically, perhaps all of the items are wrapped in plastic. Maybe a reminder that reality is scarier than our imaginations sometimes. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Runners from around the world are en route to the New York City Marathon. It is this weekend, the final major marathon of the calendar year. The race always attracts top talent. When the starting gun goes off, the athletes at the front of the pack will be big international stars. But behind them will be thousands of runners with stories of their own. The World's Bianca Hillier brings us one that is exceptional.
It's a few days before the New York City Marathon, and I'm standing right at the finish line, which is still being set up. On Sunday, 55,000 runners are going to do everything they can to get here. And for many of them, how long it takes to do that is not the important part.
I just simply hope, you know, to finish the marathon.
That's Koichi Kitabatake, and like many people, he's trained for months and crossed international borders to run this race, traveling all the way from his home in Kanagawa, Japan. But there's one thing about Kitabatake that sets him apart from everyone else.
I'm 91 years old today.
At 91 years old, Kitabatake is the oldest person registered to run this year's New York City Marathon. He says he wasn't particularly athletic for most of his life and had a career in business and telecommunications. But after retiring at 70 years old, he wanted a way to keep his body and mind sharp.
For me, retirement, you know, was just the beginning of my life. So I participated in local running race, you know, 5K or 10K.
That's about 3 to 6 miles. But soon he got that elusive runner's high and kept running longer distances. At 78 years old, he ran his first marathon. Since then, he hasn't stopped and now has 33 marathons under his belt, 12 in Japan and 21 overseas.
I always enjoy running, you know, overseas.
And he's been breaking records as he goes. Last year, he became the oldest person ever to finish a marathon on Australian soil, and he could become the world champion of the 80-plus age group on Sunday. He does have competition, though. There are actually 68 runners in this year's New York City Marathon in their 80s and 90s. As for how Kitabatake does what he does, he says there's no secret. Instead, a simple and consistent routine. First, he wakes up around 5 a.m. to beat the heat.
I do a little workout and stretching every morning for about a half an hour.
After that, about twice a week, he'll go out for a 3 or 4 mile jog, depending on how he feels. He says he definitely gets tired, but keeps up the practice because running teaches him about patience and perseverance. He also likes being around younger people.
I joined a couple of running group, you know, in Japan, and most of them are very young, and that probably contributes, you know, to keep me young.
Young at 91, with 26.2 miles on deck for Sunday. The race may end when he crosses the finish line, but the celebration will continue. A birthday celebration. Kitabatake turns 92 the very next day. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier, New York.
Halloween parties have become quite popular in India, and ghost stories, India has plenty of those. From Kolkata, reporter Sandeep Roy explains that you can learn a lot about a country's history by looking at its demons and monsters.
Rakesh Khanna found this out while researching what might be the first ever illustrated A to Z guide of the ghosts, monsters, and demons of India.
I think there's 322 entries, and there's some you know subcategories. So I think maybe somewhere around 700 totally.
From the Avi of South India, which is like the sigh that leaves the body at the moment of death to linger on as a ghost, to the Zun Hindor from Mizoram in northeastern India, which has the disgusting habit of drinking from puddles of other people's urine. Khanna, who grew up in California and now lives in Chennai in India, says Western ghosts, think Casper or Moaning Myrtle from Harry Potter, are different.
They tend to be kind of wispy, transparent things that float around in the dark, and they don't really interact with matter that much.
Indian ghosts are different.
Indian ghosts tend to be, you know, you can touch them, they can pick things up. They like to work.
The Deyam, for example, has a long tongue which can wiggle into the next room and do chores like turning off the gas burner. The ghosts of India reflect its diverse geography. Ghosts from the chilly mountains of Kashmir wear fur caps. Mecho boots from Bengal, a land of rivers, love fish, while the islands of the Indian Ocean are the romping grounds of the Faru Fureta reef monster.
Faru Fureta, which smells like stinky old sponges and corals and eats people and has crystal daggers for teeth. They're cool.
Also, centuries of sea trade and migration meant Indian ghosts have found a perch in parts of Southeast Asia. The beautiful Mohini Pay smells of jasmine flowers, but sucks out the life of anyone she bewitches. She haunted Tamil Nadu in South India. Now she's crossed oceans.
You know, you have Mohini Pays now in Singapore and Tamil ghosts, which have appeared recently in the folklore of Malaysia and Singapore.
The ghost A to Z reflects disquieting social truths going way back. Branding women witches was a way to seize their property. Many ghosts are women.
Murdered women are often reincarnated as yakshas who go and take revenge on the people who did them wrong.
Waves of invaders and migrants have also brought their own ghosts and monsters to India. There are 2,000-year-old statues of yakshas, supernatural deities left over perhaps from some pre-Hindu animist faith. Then there are ultra-modern ghosts like Rose, model employee on the night shift at a call center near Delhi.
And then she never comes back, and when they look her up, they find out that the building was built on top of a cemetery where Rose was buried.
But while modernity might have given us a rose or two, in general, it's not good for ghosts, says Rakesh Khanna.
A lot of people say that electric lights have driven them away.
But with 700 ghosts and monsters at his disposal, his Halloween costume choices, at least, are a lot richer. But he says he'll probably keep it simple.
I might just go with being a Yeti. It's nice and simple. Get a big hairy costume and some stilts.
Except, according to ghosts, monsters, and demons of India, there are about half a dozen kinds of yetis, big and small, to choose from. For the world, this is Sandeep Roy in Kolkata.
That story from Eastern India first aired in 2021. Stay tuned. Later in the program, we will take you to the Yarmouk refugee camp. It is outside of the Syrian capital, Damascus. During the country's long and devastating civil war, the camp was a war zone. Much of it was destroyed. Today, residents are returning and rebuilding. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. In the West African country of Mali, daily life has come to a standstill in many places. Schools are closed. The markets are mostly empty, especially in the capital, Bamako. That is because jihadist groups trying to overthrow the government have cut off Mali's supply of fuel. It is a brazen move by an offshoot of Al-Qaeda known by the acronym JNIM or JNIM. It is also part of a larger conflict in Africa's Sahel region, which is a string of countries that sit between the Sahara Desert to the north and the tropics to the south. The World's Jerry Haddon reports.
In the capital city of Bamako, gas stations are just about the only places bustling with activity. The lines of mostly young men with motorcycles are long. Since early this month, there's been little to no fuel reaching the pumps.
Hier à aujourd'hui, j'ai eu toutes les difficultés du monde. J'ai dû pousser ma moto de 10 couronnes.
It's been an extremely difficult day, one young man told France 24 TV this week. I had to push my motorcycle 6 miles to reach this gas station.
Je sais que nos autorités trouveront une solution à ce problème.
I'm sure the authorities will fix this problem, said another man standing by an empty pump. Even if we have to park our motorcycles and walk, we're ready, he said. We know we are at war. At war with an emboldened jihadist coalition that has been gaining ground in Mali for over a decade. But Janine's fuel blockade is a first.
Sur le terrain malien, la situation est devenue de plus en plus catastrophique.
The situation is catastrophic, says Bakare Sambe. He directs the African Center for Peace Studies at the Timbuktu Institute in Mali. The jihadist insurgency used to be confined to the northern regions, he tells me, but it's spreading all over now, including to western Mali, which until now has been a sanctuary, he says. Mali is landlocked, and that western region is its lifeline, because Mali depends on neighbors to the west, such as Senegal, for fuel imports. That fuel arrives by road, carried in on hundreds of tanker trucks each day. Ulf Lessing heads the Sahel program at the Konrad Adenauer Foundation in Bamako. He says the Janine's targeting of those convoys is a significant and worrying escalation in the conflict.
They do it a bit like insurgents in Iraq. They place IEDs on the road and to hit the first truck in a convoy and then attack the last one. So the whole, 40 trucks get stuck, and then the roads are in bad shape, full of potholes, so move very slowly.
Lessing says Mali's current military government doesn't have the means to keep those roads open. Not like it might have, he says, when it had help from the West.
Yeah, when I arrived here in 21, Mali was still firmly in the Western camp. There were French troops. There was a cooperation with the U.S., and there was UN peacekeeping force.
Back in 2013, French forces succeeded in driving the jihadists into the far north, containing the threat. It was called Operation Barkhane. It was a tactical victory, says Bakare Sambe. People celebrated.
Le succès de l'opération Serval n'était qu'une victoire tactique et non stratégique. Je crois que l'erreur stratégique majeure.
But as a long-term strategy, it failed, he says. While the French succeeded in disrupting the jihadists, they couldn't force the Malian government to rebuild the state, the army, the justice system in the liberated areas. The military operation didn't address the root causes of discontent, he says: bad governance, corruption, social injustice. The government's failure to establish a credible presence in rural areas created a power vacuum, says Intisar Fakir, a Sahel expert at the Middle East Institute in Washington. The Janine slowly returned, once again terrorizing local populations, and that, she says, is when anger toward France boiled over.
Back then there was very much this sense that, the French have sort of failed, that their approach had not succeeded. And then all of this, fed into this rising perception of sort of the need to assert sovereignty.
In 2021, Mali's military used that resentment to stage a coup against a Western-backed government. France had maintained influence in Mali since giving up colonial control in 1960. Many Malians resented what they perceived as ongoing arrogance, according to Ulf Lessing.
French diplomats, business people, even intellectuals, patronizing Africans. That's the main reason why France has become so unpopular.
Nous avions une relation sécuritaire. C'était notre engagement contre le terrorisme depuis 2013. On avait
raison. Case in point, just this January, French President Emmanuel Macron accused Mali and other countries in the Sahel of being ungrateful for France's military assistance. They forgot to say thank you, he said, and continued, Mali, Burkina Faso, Niger, none would be a sovereign country today if the French army had not been deployed in the region. Those comments angered Malians and people across the Sahel, as did the attitude of other Europeans, some on the ground. Lessing says a couple of years ago, he visited a European Union training camp in Mali, teaching basic infantry skills to Malian soldiers.
The catch was, some members, such as Germany, didn't want real guns being used, so they asked soldiers to pick branches from trees or use wooden sticks to simulate guns.
This was humiliating. Not long after, a rival power showed up offering real guns, Russia. First via the private mercenary outfit, the Wagner Group, then the Russia Corps, another militia with ties to the Kremlin. They've sent thousands of fighters to the region to defend the military junta.
La Russie, via Africa Corps, avant c'était Wagner, offre un partenariat sécuritaire rapide.
Russia, via its mercenaries, has created a fast, pragmatic security partnership in the Sahel, says Bakare Sambe, without placing all the Western conditions about democracy, good governance, and human rights. As to what Russia gets, a geopolitical foothold that delivers a strategic blow to the liberal Western order. Not to be outdone, China and Turkey have also sent weapons to Mali's government and made investments in infrastructure. But there's no guarantee Mali and these partners can hold the Janim off. Hundreds of thousands of Malians have fled the fighting and economic disarray. Many head for Europe by boat from Mauritania, says Beatriz de León Cobo. She's a fellow at the Royal United Services Institute, a security think tank in the UK.
The biggest nationality that came to the coast of the Canary Islands in 2024 were Malians. So clearly there is a correlation between unstable region. The lack of security, the lack of justice, the lack of everything means that quite a lot of youth decides to try to come to Europe.
Mali is not the only Sahel country caught up in this conflict. Neighboring Burkina Faso and Niger are battling Islamist insurgencies too. Both are ruled by military juntas that also reject Western help in that fight. Analysts worry jihadists are gaining an upper hand and could spread instability further across the region. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon.
British Prime Minister Keir Starmer has welcomed the decision by Buckingham Palace to strip Prince Andrew of all of his titles. That decision is in response to allegations of sexual abuse against him and his purported connection to American sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein. Scrutiny has only grown since the posthumous publication of a memoir by one of Epstein's most outspoken victims. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Berry joins us for more. Hey there, Orla.
Hi, Carolyn.
So this controversy around Prince Andrew and his ties to Jeffrey Epstein is not new. It has been going on for years. What finally brought things to a head this week?
Well, we should say that we never fully know the decisions that are made by King Charles and Buckingham Palace because they are always shrouded in secrecy. But undoubtedly, it's the drip feed of stories about Andrew that were just endless in recent times. The biggest bombshell being the posthumous publication of the memoir of Virginia Giuffrain, the woman who alleged that she was trafficked by Jeffrey Epstein three times for sex with Andrew when she was still a teenager. She was still 17 years of age. Giuffrain took her own life last April, and Andrew himself has always denied those allegations, but the stories have been continuing to trickle out in the last few days, including that he had lied about the last time he was in contact with Epstein. So in the past week in the UK, you had the King, for example, having meetings. He met Pope Leo in the Vatican and prayed together. It was a very historic occasion, but stories about Andrew kept and overshadowing all of that. So one has to imagine that the King is looking out for the future of the monarchy. If the monarchy is to survive, he has to make sure the British public are on side. So this was an exercise in damage limitation.
So yesterday, Buckingham Palace issued a statement saying that Andrew would cease to be Prince Andrew. He will be called Andrew Mountbatten Windsor going forward. For survivors of abuse by Jeffrey Epstein and the family of Virginia Giuffrain, how meaningful is that decision from Buckingham Palace?
Yeah, the family of Giuffrain herself, they released a statement after the news came out saying this was a moment of victory for her, if a bittersweet one. She's not around to appreciate it. As they put it, an ordinary American girl from an ordinary American family brought down a British prince with her truth and extraordinary courage. More significantly, they said this is not the end, that they would continue Virginia's battle for her. And I spoke just a short time ago with Amy Wallace, who co-wrote Giuffrain's memoir with her. And she said, first of all, you know, this was a moment of great victory for Giuffrain. But also, she said, those in power in the US should now follow the example set by King Charles.
You know, she's held power to account. And I hope that it's the beginning of a reckoning. You know, this is not just about Prince Andrew. He is just one of the many men that Virginia was trafficked to, and it was always her wish that they all be held to account. So the United States has some catching up to do, and the leadership of our country, the Department of Justice, the FBI, they need to do their jobs, and they need to stand up for these women once and for all.
The British government has commented on the case, as have various political parties there. Is that unusual?
It is quite unusual, actually, because from the government's perspective, they try and stay away usually from issues involving the royal family as much as possible. Keir Starmer issued the statement today, as you said. We also had the leader of the opposition Conservative Party, Kemi Badenoch, saying she welcomed the move. And also there was a reference, and we hear Amy Wallace sort of alluding to it there. There is a reference as to whether Andrew will be called to testify before a congressional committee in the US regarding his connections to Epstein. Now, we know members of the Democratic Party in the US have called for that to happen. One thing I should say is my understanding is he can't be compelled to testify before a US committee because he's a British citizen who lives outside of the US. But we'll have to wait. We'll have to wait and see what happens there. Yeah.
So Andrew has lost his title. He will no longer be known as Prince Andrew. What else does that mean for him, basically, beyond a name change?
Well, first of all, he'll have to move out of his current home, which is a not inconsiderable 30-room mansion, the Royal Lodge, and move to Sandringham Estate, which is not inconsiderable estate. The difference being it's a private estate owned by King Charles. Now, he'll live in a home on the estate. It's a 20,000-acre estate, so there will be some home for him. It is, I mean, it's a total fall from grace. He is the first royal to lose a title in modern times. Even Prince Harry and all the falling out with the family, he has never lost his title. But he is still in line for the throne. He's eighth in line, Carolyn, some way down in line, but he still maintains his line for the throne. Oh. We're expecting that will not be a dilemma that Buckingham Palace will ever have to face. But no doubt the King will be hoping that this statement now, if there are any further revelations, that he will have put enough distance between the royal family and Andrew, that the institution, the firm, as it's known, Buckingham Palace, will not suffer if further revelations come to light.
Orla Berry, Europe correspondent for The World, thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Carolyn.
The fall of Syria's longtime dictator Bashar al-Assad last December ushered in a new era for the country. Signs of change are visible across Syria, including in one refugee camp. Yarmouk used to be home to about 100,000 Palestinians. The place was mostly destroyed during the civil war, but now life is slowly returning. The World's Shirin Jafari visited the camp in the spring and brings us this story.
Yarmouk camp is a visual reminder of the atrocities that Bashar al-Assad and his allies carried out in Syria. Bombing campaigns, sieges of entire neighborhoods, punishment for standing up to the Assad regime. Just south of the capital, Damascus, this was once a thriving neighborhood. Today, whole apartment blocks are shattered and half standing, their walls peppered with bullet holes. The air smells of dust and diesel.
Some parts of the camp, there are still explosives that have remained from the war. And the way that you know there are explosives is that people pile up rubble at the entrance of a alleyway, and you know that you must not enter.
Displaced Palestinians settled in this camp in the 1950s. Over the years, Yarmouk grew into something bigger, not just a refugee camp, but a lively urban neighborhood with schools, bakeries, and bookstores. But the war in Syria upended the lives of people living here once again. The Syrian forces laid siege to the camp, starving those who remained. They also bombed the entire camp. Now this is the soundtrack to Yarmouk. Workers rebuilding, families slowly returning. Manal Musa and her sister are among those who have returned. I meet them in their apartment up a flight of stairs. From the outside, it's hard to imagine anyone living here. There are no windows. Most of the building is still destroyed. But one room stands, and that's where we sit. They offer me black coffee in tiny cups. Musa says she's happy to be back in what is left of her home after all these years. But the level of destruction is as if we've gone back 100 years, she says. The water and sewage systems have been decimated. There's no electricity. At night, it's not safe, especially for women, she says.
Completely destroyed. Yeah. It was bombed.
Musa shows me pictures of what the room we're sitting in looked like when they first returned a couple of months ago. The sisters cleared the rubble by hand, she tells me. They couldn't afford to hire laborers.
When you heard about the fall of Bashar al-Assad, how did that make you feel? What did you feel?
Happy. We feel happy. All of us, we feel happy.
Musa, who switches to English from time to time, tells me she hopes the dark days of war and displacement are over. It will take a long time to rebuild, she says, but at least her family is no longer moving from one place to another. Back outside, there are few businesses open. One of them is a falafel stand run by Abu Muhammad, a tall, skinny man with jet black hair. Everything was destroyed, he tells me, in between making sandwiches for a group of kids waiting impatiently. We had to leave our home with the clothes on our back, he says. Abu Muhammad, his wife, and 3 children were forced to move 8 times during the war, he says. Wherever in Syria they went, the bombings followed them. We were tired of renting outside the camp, he says. So when we heard that people are coming back, we decided to return. With no help from the government, Abu Muhammad estimates that it will take years to fully rebuild his home and falafel shop. But he's glad he's back. As I leave, I spot a Ferris wheel in the distance. It's like it's frozen in time. Its rusty cabins are dangling in the wind. For many Palestinians, this camp was a home in exile. Those I talk to here say it may never return to what it was before. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari, Damascus, Syria.
You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. This weekend, Mexico celebrates Dia de Muertos. The Day of the Dead is when people across the country build altars overflowing with flowers, food, and gifts for their ancestors who come to visit the living for a day. There's also a popular character who always shows up, La Catrina. She is an elegant female skeleton wearing a fancy long dress and a flowered hat. From our radio archive, The World's Tibi Saizea takes us to one big parade in Mexico City for the story of how La Catrina became such an iconic symbol in Mexican culture.
It was my first time at the parade of Catrinas in Mexico City, and I found myself in good company. Keisha and Emily are 2 sisters who are pretty anxious for the parade to get started. They came from the state of Hidalgo with their grandma. Their faces are painted like Catrinas, which Emily describes for me.
Muy colorida y su cara que es muy sonriente.
She's very colorful and her face is smiley. She wears an elegant dress with flowers and ornaments on her head.
Hola, Catrina! Hola!
The girls say hi to all the different types of Catrinas.
Las Catrinas que vienen en carro.
The ones who come in a car.
Ah, son mariposas.
The butterfly Catrinas.
Son arcoiris.
A rainbow Catrina.
Es un músico. Calavera.
And a musician's call. The Parade of Catrinas is a new tradition in Mexico City, starting in 2016, and it was inspired by a James Bond movie from the year before. In In the opening scene, Bond makes his way through a Day of the Dead carnival that, until then, was not a tradition in the city. But in real life, of course, it's much more fun.
Bata! Bata!
The girls are having a blast, but their grandmother, Maria Isabel Barrios, says she actually doesn't like this parade that much.
Pues a mí casi no me gusta. No, porque por eso se están perdiendo las tradiciones.
Because we are losing our tradition, she says, one that goes back thousands of years. She says back in the day, Día de Muertos was celebrated in households or cemeteries where families can connect with their ancestors in a more intimate way.
Ya ahora los nietos pues ya no les llama la atención nada de esto, de poner una ofrenda.
The kids don't want to make altars and offerings anymore. They prefer to go out to the streets, she says.
Muchas cosas nuevas.
Too many new things. The customs, the Catrinas, none of that existed, she says. In fact, La Catrina is also a relatively new invention by Mexican illustrator José Guadalupe Posada in the early 20th century. It was not created for Day of the Dead, but rather it was a satire of Mexican society. Posada started painting different characters with skulls for faces, regardless of their class or status. Lalo Alcaraz is a Mexican-American cartoonist and an admirer of Posada.
Posada made a representation of a woman who thought she was fancy in a kind of a European style, but she's more of a Mexican trying to look fancy.
Posada's illustrations were published in Mexican newspapers, but it wasn't until the 1950s when La Catrina really became famous. That's when Mexican artist Diego Rivera, the former husband of Frida Kahlo, included La Catrina in one of his murals. The day after the parade, I went to visit this huge mural with Josan Anabelica, a historian from the Mexican Autonomous University. It depicts dozens of the most important characters in the history of Mexico. And at the very center,
La Catrina, la cual está representada con vestimenta.
It's La Catrina. She's wearing a fancy feather shawl and a big hat decorated with flowers. Lalo Alcaraz says La Catrina is an equalizer for Mexican society.
It shows, you know, that we're all equal under the skin. Strip away all the money and the class and the fancy tastes, and we're all the same. That is a beautiful thing, I think.
This, he says, is a perfect match for Mexico's view of the dead and of themselves. For the world, I'm Tibisa Isea, Mexico City.
It took more than a century, but a message stuffed in a bottle by two Australian soldiers during World War I has been retrieved on Australia's coast. Deb Brown told the Associated Press that her husband and daughter came across it.
They were picking up rubbish and Felicity saw a bottle floating around in the shoreline, and she picked it up and said, "Oh, Dad, this bottle's pretty cool. It's very thick glass and it's got messages in it. We better take it home."
Inside that clear, thick glass, Brown says, were two pieces of paper.
I stuck a pair of surgical tweezers down inside and twisted and twisted and twisted until it was thin enough to pull up through the neck. And then we put the rolled up letter on the windowsill for another day to dry because it was damp. And when we opened it up, we could not believe that the writing was so clear.
They couldn't believe it because the letters were dated August 15th, 1916, and they were written in pencil by Privates Malcolm Neville and William Harley. The two were on a troop ship headed to Europe to serve in the trenches during World War I. Neville was killed in action a year later. Harley was wounded twice, but he survived the war.
We are all absolutely stunned.
Ann Turner is William Harley's granddaughter. She spoke with the Radio National Breakfast Program in Australia.
It really does feel like a miracle, and we do very much feel like our grandfather has reached out to us from the grave. And he was a grandfather none of us ever met.
Turner says by August of 1916 that her grandfather must have known how brutal the war could be. So she calls his letter just amazing.
Because it showed, I think, how he was in such high spirits 3 days after he left, and he writes this message to whoever finds it and hopes the finder is in good spirits like he is, and he hopes everything's going to go well and he'll be back in sunny South Australia soon.
The Neville family received a letter as well. Herbie Neville is the great-nephew of Private Malcolm Neville.
Yeah, it sort of brought us all closer together. It really has. I believe it has.
The bottle, by the way, is a Schweppes soda bottle, and it may not have been bobbing in the waves for an entire century. Some believe it washed up on shore decades ago and has been buried in the dunes ever since. The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Have a sweet and spooky weekend. We will see you right back here on Monday.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, macfound.org. And by FJC, a foundation of philanthropic funds serving the nonprofit sector with donor-advised funds, fiscal sponsorship, bridge lending, and more, fjc.org. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. More information at theworld.org.